Esther chapter 9 and 10. 10 is a very short chapter, just three verses. So we will finish up the book of Esther today. Let's bow for a word of prayer as we begin. Dear God in heaven, we thank you again for being with us. We thank you for the sunshine this morning. We thank you for the opportunity that we have of being able to gather together and to study your word. We ask now that you would guide and direct us, help us to receive a blessing from your word. We ask this in your precious name. Amen. Okay, we come to chapter 9 of Esther. It says, now in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain mastery over them, the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. So we go on back and we see that in Esther chapter 3, this is a little bit of review, Esther chapter 3 verse 12 says, then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict according to all that Haman commanded was written to the king's satraps, to all of the people, to every province in its own script, to every piece in its own language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus. And this was the edict that all of the Jews were to be killed. So this was on the 13th day of the first month. And now we have come in chapter 9 to the 12th month, the 13th day of the 12th month. And so it's been a year since Haman had his edict written out and it was delivered to all of the people around. Now on the third month, we had another edict that was written out, and this was the edict that was written out by King, or by Mordecai, which said that the Jews could defend themselves. It did not wipe out the edict that had been written on the first month, that all the Jews were to be killed, but the edict on the 13th day of the third month was given so that the Jews were able to defend themselves. And so they had been going 9 months since the time that they had been given the authority to defend themselves for us to come to chapter 9 and verse 1, the verse that we just read. And so they'd come to this time. Now, I'm going to read through, I'm going to spend a little more time just reading Scripture. This chapter 9, I had a hard time outlining it. I had a hard time organizing it so we could go through it step by step, verse by verse. And so I'm going to read the whole thing, and then we're just going to kind of pick bits and pieces from various parts of the chapter, and we'll outline a little bit more the events that occurred. So I've already read verse 1, and so we'll continue on from verse 2 of chapter 9. The Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm. And no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen on all peoples. All the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors and the royal agents also helped the Jews, for the fear of Mordecai had fallen on them. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread through all the provinces. For the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. The Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and did as they pleased to those who hated them. In Susa, the citadel itself, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men, and also killed Pershandatha, and Delphon, and Aspa, and Paratha, and Adelia, and Eridatha, and Parmeshta, and Arisai, and Erdai, and Vestha. The 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, but they laid no hand on the plunder. That very day, the number of those killed in Susa, the citadel, was reported to the king. And the king said to Queen Esther, in Susa, the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and also the 10 sons of Haman. What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what further is your request? And it shall be fulfilled. Let those who are in Susa be allowed tomorrow also to do according to this day's edict. And let the king commanded this to be done, a decree. The Jews who were in Susa gathered also on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they killed 300 men in Susa, but they laid no hands on the plunder. Now the rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also gathered to defend their lives and got relief from their enemies and killed 75,000 of those who hated them, but they laid no hands on the plunder. This was on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day they rested with feasting and gladness. But the Jews who were in Susa gathered on the 13th day and rested on the 15th. Day, making that a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore, the Jews of the villages who lived in the rural towns hold the 14th day of the month of Adar as a day for gladness and feasting, as a holiday, and as a day on which they send gifts of food to one another. So, we see the events that occurred here, and we see the example again of this word that we had about a month, maybe 5-6 weeks ago, peripety. Does anybody remember the definition of the word peripety? I was going to ask you if you remembered the word, but I figured, no, I won't do that. So what was the definition, or what actually happened to individuals that had peripety? Okay, a sudden change of events. And so this was the day that the Jews were supposed to be killed, to the first edict that was signed by Haman. And so now they were given the opportunity to defend themselves. And so we have this total change in the fortunes of the Jews. And it goes through here and talks about the extent of their... we see first off that Mordecai talks about him. It says in verse 4, "For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces. For the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful." We see the change that has occurred in the attitude toward Mordecai and to the position of Mordecai. If we go back to Esther chapter 6 and verse 10, there it said, "Then the king said to Haman, 'Hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned.'" So in the first reference of him, he was just Mordecai the Jew. And he was sitting in the king's gate. He was... probably had some official duty in the king's gate, but now we see that he is second to King Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, to chapter 9, and that there is a fear of him. It talks about the fear and the respect that the people had for him and for the fame that he had developed. Any comments or questions on this first part as we introduce this? Okay, then we see the extent of the killing. We had 500 people that were killed in Susa on the 13th day, and 300 more were killed on the 14th day. Now, these were just the men that were killed. The edict that went out, according to, that was written by Mordecai, what did it allow for the Jews to do? What was the permission that they had? Did someone answer? Yes. Okay, they could fight back. And to what extent could they fight back? Okay, they could kill the women and children also, and they could take plunder. So they could take all of the goods that these individuals, that the Persians had. And so, but they didn't do that. It mentions this three separate times in this chapter, that they did not take the plunder. Any idea on why they would have done this? Why they did not take the plunder? Okay. All right. So we have that aspect that they were going to allow this to go to the king. They were not going to take this. Yes, Dan. Okay. Okay. This was their main thing, was to keep the Jewish nation alive. And we're going to see this as we go on a little bit further, and we'll see the emphasis of the battle. And now the battle could have certain different emphases, it could have certain different effects on it, and different battles as the children of Israel went on, came on in. For instance, as the children of Israel came in through the, across the Jordan River, and they took over the cities, what were some of the things that they did and did not do as they took over the land of Israel? First off, we had Jericho. What happened at Jericho? They totally destroyed the city. They killed the people and totally destroyed the city. Did they totally destroy other cities as they took over the country? They didn't. Why would they not have totally destroyed all of these cities as they came on in? Yes, Eric. Okay. Okay. Okay, all right. So we had Jericho and... Right. Yes. Ai was the next city where they got defeated. But there's one other city in northern part of Israel that they also totally burned as they came on in. There's a very practical reason why they did not burn and totally destroy the cities as they came on in. Yes. They were going to use them, right. They had just spent 40 years in the wilderness. And so they didn't have a lot of things to be able to start up farming and building and all of this type of thing. And so there are different purposes for the way that God allowed some of these nations to come on in. And so we have the situation here in Esther where the edict said that they could take the plunder, but they did not. They only destroyed the men, and they left the women and children, and they left the plunder there. And we'll see a little bit more of why they did this. Now we also see that there was, talked about the people that were killed in the villages, and this actually doesn't come out until later on, where it says that they had killed 75,000, okay, in verse 16, they killed 75,000 of those who hated them. There's a little bit of controversy as to the number that we have here. The Septuagint, which is, you'll see this as LXX, which stands for 70, So the Septuagint was the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. And in the Greek translation, it says 15,000 that were killed out there in the villages. And I don't know which number is correct. I don't think it makes any difference. I'm just letting you know that I am aware of this. But there were a lot of people that were killed during this time. But again, out there in the villages, it says they laid no hands on the plunder. Now, after this was done, after they had won the victory, we now have the time of feasting. And so this was the time when they were to rejoice over what had happened here. And so on the 14th day in the villages, on the 13th day they had the war, and on the 14th day this was now a day of feasting. In Susa, Queen Esther asked for another day. And so they killed not only on the 13th, but also on the 14th. And so then the 15th was the day of rejoicing and feasting in the city of Susa. Now, this whole time, it says then we go on verse 24. For Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them, and had cast pur, that is, cast lots, to crush and to destroy them. But when it came before the king, he gave orders to writing that this evil plan that he had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged in the gallows. Therefore they call these days Purim, after the term Pur. So we have the Feast of Purim, which is inaugurated at this time. It started out as simply being a day of rejoicing, a day that they could now rest, relax, enjoy their families, enjoy their possessions, etc. See, how long had they been under this edict that they were going to be killed? It was a year. Exactly a year that they had been under this edict that they were to be killed. Now, the edict had been given out 9 months before that they were able to protect themselves. But still, you know, if you have something that has been given to you that you are going to suffer some type of a drastic event in your life in the future, this is going to color all of the days up to that time. Even if you have assurance that you should probably be able to take care of this, but you still are thinking about this, probably give you sleepless nights. And so the individuals had this, but on these days now, they were able to realize that they had been able to be successful. Their war had been successful. They had killed those that hated them. Now, I just checked to see. Purim is still a holiday which is celebrated by the Jews, by many of the Jews, not all of them. But in the year 2017, it was March 12th and 13th. And in 2018, it's going to be March 13th. It's going to be, the 12th and 13th also. So we see that it's usually during the month of March is when this Purim is taking place. Let's just talk about these festivals just a little bit that we have here since this one was initiated. This was not something that was given to the Jews by God when He gave them their commands and the things that they were supposed to do. The book of Leviticus, if you read through the book of Leviticus, this is one of those books that when you're reading through the Bible, you might, you know, take a couple pages at a time as you're going through this. All of the detail that we have there, but this is where the feasts were given to them. Purim was not given to them at this time. and also Hanukkah. Purim and Hanukkah are two feasts that the Jews use, that they celebrate, that were not given to them from God. The ones that they were given was the Passover. And Passover feast was what? What does that commemorate? Okay, this is when the angel of death passed over those that had the blood on the doorpost, and so the firstborn son was not killed. Then we have the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, not known quite as well as Passover, but this was just a few days after Passover when the Feast of Unleavened Bread took place, and this was to signify their hurried leaving of the land of Egypt. Now, once the firstborn son had been killed, they had to get out of there in a hurry, because the Pharaoh figured out that it was because of the Jews that all of this tragedy had happened to his people, and so they had to leave in a hurry. Why would unleavened bread be a symbol of leaving quickly? Yes, Lori. Okay, the bread didn't have time to rise. They just mixed the dough and got out of there. And so they didn't wait around for it to rise. Now, leaven later on also is the picture of sin, but at this time the unleavened bread probably is not. It's just the aspect that they were picking up and getting out of there in a hurry. So there was Passover, unleavened bread. Then we had the Feast of First Fruits. And the Feast of First Fruits was the first crops that they were given. And so when the crops came in, they were supposed to give some of their crops to the Lord, the first part of the crops to the Lord, the beginning of the harvest. Then we also had the Feast of Weeks. The Feast of Weeks we call Pentecost. Yes, Eric. Yes. Okay. All right. So they get three for the price of one, though. All right. Only one trip to Jerusalem rather than three. Now, they didn't have to go to Jerusalem for all of these. So anyway, so we had those three feasts, and then we had the Feast of Weeks or Pentecost. What do you know about Pentecost just from the word itself? This is a game I play with my students all the time. Try and dissect the word to figure out what it means so you don't have to memorize so much stuff. P-E-N-T. Eric. Okay. Five. You've got the five in there. Penta is five. So Pentecost is 50 days, and we celebrate Pentecost 50 days after what? Yes. Well, resurrection, right. 50 days after resurrection. That's Pentecost. And so Pentecost here was 50 days after the Passover, and this was basically the end of the harvest. And so these four feasts, Passover, Unleavened Bread, First Fruits, and the Feast of Weeks, or Pentecost, were all in the spring of the year. Then we had three other feasts, so there were seven feasts that the children of Israel were supposed to obey. We had the Feast of Trumpets, which is the end of the agricultural year. So the agricultural year in Israel is a little bit different than it is here in southern Minnesota. There they had fall fruits and they had spring fruits and so on. And so you had several sessions there. But the end of the agricultural year was the Feast of Trumpets. Then we had the Day of Atonement. This was also 10 days after the Feast of Trumpets. These two are in the fall. And then we had the Feast of the tabernacles or the Feast of Booths, which was also given to them. And in this, they would leave their homes and they would now tent out for a bit. So they would have tents or booths that they would live in. And the first two, the Feast of Trumpets and Day of Atonement, this had to do more with their thankfulness for what God had done for them. But what did the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of the Booths, what did this commemorate? Time when they lived in tents. What was the time when they lived in tents? The wilderness wanderings, right. So those were the seven feasts that they were given in Leviticus. And so now we have these two feasts that were given extra biblical. Yes, Eric. Yes. Right. Right. Okay. And I was going to point that out, and I just slipped by just a little bit. But yes, this was the Day of Atonement, Yom Day, Hebrew word for day. And this was the only day that the priest could go into the Holy of Holies and then make the atonement for the people. So these feasts that we have were given in Leviticus for the children of Israel to obey. But then we had the feast, the Purim. And obviously, Purim, what does Purim signify? Or what does it commemorate? We've just spent 2 months talking about it. Okay, the fact that they were not killed, they were not eradicated. The Jews were not eradicated by Haman, who was at the time the second in command to King Xerxes. Then we also saw Purim is not listed in Leviticus, but it is listed in Esther. And so we've been reading about Purim, which was here. And the word Purim is simply the plural of Pur. And Pur is simply casting lots. And so it's the aspect that their lots were just cast, that all of the Jews were going to be killed, and there was really no rhyme or reason to this other than the edict that had been written by Haman. So now we have Hanukkah. What does Hanukkah celebrate? Yes, Eric? About 160, something like that, yes.
So the Greek ruler of the area of Israel after Alexander the Great, Antiochus?
Right, Antiochus Epiphanes.
Epiphanes.
Right.
Epiphanes was a ruthless guy and tried to eliminate the religion of Judaism through all sorts of government edicts. I mean, it was really awful. Like if a Torah scroll was found in your home, the entire family was killed and the home was left. Things like that.
Right.
He was very anti-Judaism and he just tried to eliminate it from the kingdom.
Okay.
And he put up a statue of Zeus in the temple, in the Holy of Holies, and desecrated it and all kinds of stuff.
Right. Okay.
Ceremonially cleansed it and started it functioning again.
All right.
And there's a tradition that at that time there was a special oil olive oil prescribed in Leviticus on how it was to be prepared.
Mm-hmm.
It was only that specially prepared olive oil that could burn the lamp in the temple. they only had about like a day's worth of this oil to burn. But supposedly, by tradition, it burned for like a whole week.
Okay.
Even though they only had like a day's worth in there.
All right. They were very good on this. But the Maccabean revolt was because Antiochus Epiphanes had, as he said, desecrated the temple. He actually worshipped, he actually slaughtered a pig on the altar, and they were giving sacrifices by means of pigs, which to the Jews are totally unclean. And so he had done all of these, and Maccabees was a, I'm not sure just exactly what his position was, but he had five sons. And those six individuals, they started this revolt, and they were able to take this over. Now, I thought it was interesting that Judah Maccabees was also known as Judah the Hammer. See, this is pre-world wrestling times when we had a guy by the name of Judah the Hammer. Anyway, he was one of the sons, and he was involved with helping to cleanse the temple. And Hanukkah is a remembrance of this. And Hanukkah is mentioned in John chapter 10. John chapter 10, verses 22 and 23. At that time, the Feast of Dedication, this is also the name for Hanukkah, took place at Jerusalem. It was winter. And Jesus was walking in the temple in the colonnade of Solomon. And they talk about this. But the Feast of Dedication is the same as the Feast of, or as Hanukkah. And Hanukkah is one of the holidays that is celebrated by Jews today quite commonly. Okay, then we'll continue on. And now, as I said, the Jews did not kill the women and children. They did not take the plunder. And so I want to see, now I'm going to read several verses here and see what was the purpose for this. What were they supposed to emphasize as a result of the fulfilling the edict that had been given, that they could defend themselves? Verse 20, and Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month Adar and also the 15th day of the same year by year, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies and as the month that had been turned from them from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews accepted what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. So what was supposed to be the emphasis of the fulfilling of the edict that Mordecai had written out? Was this supposed to emphasize a military victory? Yes, Grant. We welcome Grant back to Sunday school again. So,
I would guess that the remembrances that Mordecai had here for the feast days, which would give credit to God.
Okay. All right. Credit to God, and instead of a military victory, boasting about a military victory, they were supposed to appreciate the fact that they were now living in a country in which they were not going to be killed. This was for them to emphasize the peace and the serenity that they could have living in this country. If you think about this, of being, if you live in an area where there's constant war, conflict, etc., some of the areas of Africa, North Korea, so on, what kind of a relief it must be to get them to where these are not a problem. I have an aunt who lived in Germany. She came to the United States when she was 13, 14 years old but she went through World War II in Russia and Germany. And when she came even to the United States, the first year or so, she went to the same grade school as I did, and whenever we would see or hear a plane, a country grade school, this was something that, boy, we would run to the window to look at a plane. This was a real big thing to see a plane out there. She would never want to look at that. She went underneath the desk every time a plane went overhead, because this brought back memories of bombs coming down where they were living. Even though she was living in a country now where bombs were not imminent, she still had this fear. But the Jews were supposed to remember this, that they were now at peace. A couple of other things that they were supposed to do, that this Feast of Purim was supposed to emphasize. And what were those? Okay, to give gifts. They were supposed to give gifts. They were supposed to give gifts and food to one another and gifts to the poor. So this was not supposed to be something that they were thinking about how great they were and what they had done, but the gifts that were given to them, and probably also that this would be something that was given from God to them, that God had given them this victory. So we see that they were supposed to emphasize the gift-giving, the gifts to the poor, and their now their peacefulness. Then we have, continuing on through the rest of those few verses there, we see pretty much the same thing as iterated, that we had iterated before. And it says in verse 28 that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, in every clan, province, and city, that these days of Purim should never fall into disuse among the Jews, nor should the commemoration of these days cease among their descendants. The Jews still, many of the Jews still celebrate Purim today. Should they? Is there a reason why they should celebrate Purim? Since this is extra-biblical, this is something that is brought in, this is not something that was given to them by God. Should they continue with this? Eric. Okay. Okay. Any other comments on this? Yes, Grant.
Well, if it's a day of deliverance, which was crucial at this time, but also it was a day of deliverance that came and they don't recognize.
Okay.
So I guess on the one hand, I can understand why they would. I believe from a biblical perspective, they shouldn't. The day of deliverance should be Jesus Christ.
Okay. Yes. Okay, so what might be a reason why they should celebrate Purim, even the Christians celebrate it? Eric.
Okay. That doesn't make sense.
All right. Okay.
But to celebrate both,
Okay? Chuck. Okay, all right. Yes, Chris.
Yeah, I guess I would have to be careful to not think that the nation, to think that a nation is not allowed to celebrate these holidays. If, it sounds like we're getting into conditionals now.
All right. Okay.
And I personally don't see anything wrong with it. We've done that as a nation. Could that be done in a way that dishonors God? Yes.
Right.
But should they be given the liberty to do that? I believe so.
Okay. See, the Jews are Judaism is a historical religion. There is a history to that. And this is one of the things that Bookman talks about. If you go on the Israel trips, Christianity is a historical religion. You can walk in the same pavement stones that Jesus walked on. You can see the areas where Jesus worshiped. You can see all of these things. You can see where these events occurred. And our Christianity and the Jewish religion are really the only two that are based on actual historical events, certifiable historical events. And so Purim, again, is a historical, certifiable historical event when they were delivered. And so we should remember this, that we should be able to remember our history that we have. Now, there's one other thing that I want to spend just a little bit of time on as we finish this up. Chapter 10, as it says, and King Ahasuerus imposed tax on the land and on the coastlands of the sea. And one of the commentaries that I read said, chapter 10 shows that normality has come back to the country. Taxes being imposed. I guess that is a normal situation for a new leader to be involved with. But anyway, we do see that they were going about their normal activity that we have here. Now, as you look back over the book of Esther, what are some of the big picture things that you see from Esther that we can learn about today, that we can apply to our Christianity today? Yes. What did the high priest do when he was in there in the Holy of Holies? He offered a sacrifice. And this was a sacrifice. Yep. Yeah, that was for the whole nation. Sacrifice for the whole nation. And he... Pardon? Okay, God had instituted this custom that they should come on in like that. And here's something that I find interesting, that the high priest had a rope tied to his ankle when he went on in there. So that if he did something that he was not supposed to do and God struck him dead, that they would be able to drag him out because nobody else was able to go into the Holy of Holies. That's how serious God had ordained this particular thing to take place. Only
he had to enter between
Yes, he had to enter with clean hands and go through the absolute prescribed procedure.
That rope thing, though, that's not in the Torah.
Okay. All right. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Well,
mm-hmm.
That showed the
activities
that they took it, though.
Yes.
It was added later because of the crook.
Chris. Okay.
No matter what I might think of myself or my past, God is sufficient, and He may use us for His will.
Okay. All right. Now, the events, how many miracles occurred in Esther? Now, remember, a miracle is something that God has set aside normal, natural events and has stepped on in and stepped in supernaturally and has changed things. There are no miracles in Esther. Now, God did work with the children of Israel in some miracles. What were some of the miracles that God did for the children of Israel? Let's just tick these off quickly. Okay, parting of the Red Sea. That was definitely a miracle. Okay, the pillar of flame that they have. That was a miracle. The manna, the quails. Okay, pardon? Okay, water out of the rock. We had the parting of the Jordan River, and this was, those of you that, if you've been to Israel and you see the Jordan River, it's only about as wide as from me to Jeff at some of its wider areas. It's not that imposing of a river. But when they crossed it, it was in flood stage. And so it covered that whole valley. And so that was a miracle. But then there were other things that God worked with them just through their daily activities. And so there are no miracles in Esther. All of the things that occurred here occurred because of normal activities. We would call these circumstances. So as Chris pointed out, God can use each one of us, and He has probably used. I'm not saying that there haven't been any miracles in your life. If you are saved, this is probably the greatest miracle, that God has replaced the old nature with a new nature. But as far as other things are concerned, you know, you might have said, oh, that was a miracle that that happened. No, that wasn't a miracle. It was just a big rain or something like that. So anyway, it was normal, natural events. And God is working and leading and guiding you through normal, natural events of people that He brings into your life, of circumstances that occur to you, and God can use those just as well as He can a miracle. Any other comments or questions on this? I have thoroughly enjoyed my time studying Ruth and Esther. And are you taking over next Sunday, Chris?
I thought it was December, but now I'm not sure.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, anyway, Joel has things under control. So we'll turn it over to him. Thank you. You are dismissed.